So let's get started. It's my great pleasure to introduce Ravi Madhavan, who is a PhD student at EPFL, working with Viktor Kunchek. So Ravi obtained his master's from ISC in India, and then he was a research fellow for 2 years at MSR Bangalore, working with Rama. His PhD is on proving performance properties of programs, and he's more generally interested in all kinds of program analysis and synthesis. So very excited to have you here, Ravi, and looking forward to your talk.
Thanks a lot, Sumit. Thanks for the great introduction. All right. So thanks for coming to my talk. But it's not yet over. So this is my thesis topic, so which is going to be on verifying resource bounds of programs. So what I'm going to talk about is proving properties about usage of resources, such as time or space. So there are three ways to talk about it. For instance, one can reason about it in terms of concrete physical units, in terms of actual milliseconds or the number of kilobytes that a program might take. So this I call as physical units. And a more abstract way to talk about resources is in the form of number of evaluation steps performed by a program. Or for instance, if you're talking about memory, number of objects that are allocated in the heap or on the stack. And when you're talking about these kind of resources, you can either try and establish a concrete bound in the resources. For instance, a program takes about 10 steps to complete execution. Or you can talk about more an asymptotic notion of resources. For instance, a program takes an order of n time to complete. So in this talk, what I'm going to talk about is this algorithmic notion of resources. And I'm going to try and establish concrete bounds on these algorithmic resources. For instance, a program takes, for instance, 10 steps on to complete its execution. All right. So why are these resources important? So these resources are important because it provides you a platform-independent way or a machine-independent way of reasoning about performance of a program, as compared to physical units, where the amount of time a program takes will change with platform or your architecture. The second aspect, it is a lot more convenient, and it provides a deterministic way of measuring your performance. It's not going to change with multiple executions. And maybe a more practical aspect for why we should go for these bounds is because on complex programs, these are at least more tangible and somewhat within the scope of state-of-the-art verification technology. That's more a practical aspect. And they're also somewhat beneficial if you want to compare relative performance of programs as compared to asymptotic bounds. If you want to compare two programs with similar asymptotic bounds, but they may have a grossly dissimilar number of evaluation steps. All right. So if this is some motivation for why going for these algorithmic notions of resource may not be too much of an abstraction. So here, what we did is we experimented by running it on by running programs on concrete inputs, and then we tried to measure the correlation between the number of evaluation steps, which you can also think of number of primitive operations executed by the program, against the actual running time it takes. And this plot is for a function that computes kth minimum of an unsorted list using a lazy selection sort algorithm. I'll try and explain this algorithm later. But what you find here is, so the plot shows the behavior for two functions. One function computes the kth minimum, another function computes the minimum. And what you see here is a very strong correlation between the number of steps that gets executed and the number of time, the amount of time the program takes. For instance, here, one step approximately corresponds to 1 nanosecond. So this is not, I'm not trying to generalize this and say that steps will always correspond to number of actual amount of time, but it's just some motivation for why establishing bounds with respect to these resources might be useful. Yeah.
These steps are in terms of, you know, what kind of properties of input, because it might also depend upon whether something, you know, array is already sorted or not.
So yeah, that's a good question. These are worst case number of steps that can be taken in the worst case. So we try to analyze the worst case behavior of the program for what input the program produces the worst case output. In the case of selection sort, it doesn't matter. Of course, your program should not be sorted. But for instance, perhaps the worst case is if it's sorted in the descending order for selection sort, because you're always trying to pick a minimum, putting it at the front of the list, and you're repeating it over and over again. Yeah, we actually go for worst case inputs. Yeah.
So you're assuming something about the hardware here, which is that it looks like it all fits into cache, for example, right?
We are not assuming anything about the hardware here. It's just an outcome of our experiment. So the
hardware.
This was on a JVM, not just on a hardware.
Well, okay, but I'm just saying, you know, the hardware imposes a different set of constraints, right? The size of the cache,
right.
The time it takes to service the cache.
Yeah, this is disregarding all of that.
Right. So, and this looks like it, you know, I mean, in many hardware architectures, there would be a point where there's a drop off for whatever reason. It'd be much more variable, essentially, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not saying that this is a way to predict actual running time. That's not the subject of this talk. It's just saying that this measure is not completely off. It could be a reasonable measure if you want to compare implementations compared to an asymptotic running time bounded. So So this is not the subject of the talk. To predict running time in terms of physical units is not a subject of the talk. So we are only sticking to algorithmic units. This is some motivation for you why this might still be worthwhile. Okay, so before I get to the actual approach, let me give a brief overview of how the existing techniques looks like. So as with proving correctness of software, the space of existing techniques can be classified in terms of in two dimensions. One is automation, another is the expressive power. On the on one hand, we have tools that I call as push button tools, which are completely automated or automated for the large part of it. And on the other hand, we have tools that depend on interactive theorem provers, in which the programmer has to flesh out the entire proof for verifying something. And what is somewhat striking compared to correctness verification is there's a lot of techniques that are completely automated in this space. And there are comparatively fewer, but many techniques that are also use interactive theorem provers. But there is some space in between, which is generally used in correctness verification by kind of verifiers called specification-based verifiers, in which programmers can write contracts on programs. And then the system is going to use some kind of SMT solver to automate some low-level constraints. So for instance, Daphne, and all these tools are examples of that. What we find with resource verification is a lot of techniques are completely automated. And in fact, there was one famous technique proposed by Sumit himself, which was speed. And there are very few techniques that try to exploit this space, where programmers can write contracts that may be necessary for proving bounds. And the two works that are highlighted are actually one of a couple of our previous works on this, which is also the subject of this talk. So why should we need this? Because it seems automation is all that we should care about. So the reason why this might be beneficial is because resource bounds are as hard to prove as correctness properties. In fact, one could argue it's more hard. And it is difficult to hope for a system to completely automatically come up with all the invariants you need. And so this technique allows programmers to write high-level properties that might be essential for proving resource bounds, but it automates some kind of low-level constraint solving using SMT solvers. So you may want to write down all your invariants for a red-black tree, for instance, that the tree is balanced, but you don't have to tell the tool that x greater than 0 and x less than 0 is false. That the tool can figure out. So what this also allows is some kind of modular verification in which if you have assumptions about your program, it can be encoded in the form of contracts. All right, so what? Yes.
One dimension I think that you're missing here is how important is it? Because the reason why for correctness, people are more willing to write specifications is because apparently that's more important. Correctness is the more important thing. And they're willing
Good
to
point.
Spend more effort.
So here is my counter question to you,
yes,
right?
So what you have not yet motivated is, you know, so what will happen? Let's say if a tool finds out something, right? Then what will people typically do after that? What is the end-to-end story here? Like if you find a bug, the programmer will probably fix it.
So here is one story. The one story is that this system can provide you a counterexample for the bound that you have specified. But in that case, the bound has to be somewhat concrete. You'll see what a concrete bound is. In that case, the system can say that in this input, your expectation about the program's performance is wrong, even asymptotically wrong. That is some kind of valuable input, right? And the second one is even when you're trying to implement complicated algorithms, which I will give you an overview of how they look like. In fact, when they involve lazy evaluation and things like that, then your expectation about your implementation is completely blank. All that you know is that when I run my implementation, it gives me some performance. I have no idea how that performance varies with my input. So in fact, it's very hard to measure even if you have 10 inputs and you get some random amount of time, how much it is, whether it's linear, whether it's quadratic, this aspect is very hard to measure. So I think given that we put too much effort into making a program optimal rather than developing correct programs, it makes sense to actually verify these properties. There was one example in the sense of a standard algorithm from a textbook And it turned out that it didn't handle one of the corner cases. So it didn't have the performance that it was expected out of it in, when those corner cases happened. So a verifier obviously will not go through those corner cases. So you have to try and figure out what happens in those cases and fix the problem. Yeah?
I think unlike the correctness property too, you do have two layers, right? You've got the what you're doing, the resource bounds, but then there is this mapping from the abstract to the physical machine.
Right.
Right. And that a lot of people that work on performance think about that translation, right? Because in the end, if you don't, if you ignore that, you can have a huge hit on performance. So I think, you know, it's a harder problem in the sense that, you know, you got these two things to think about. But of course, people that care, you know, will do it.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good point, and I should agree with that. But what I would try to motivate is even this first component where you're trying to implement an algorithm is not very obvious whether your algorithm satisfies the even asymptotic bounds that you expect it to satisfy for some of the kind of algorithms I'll show you. For some implementations. So even doing that part is going somewhere. And then if you can do the second part where you can correlate that your compiler does the right form of compilation, then and you get the right amount of cache hits and all those stuff, it's the second part. But this approach is mostly to deal with the first part, and that's at least tangible even if the program gets complicated. Okay. So what our system gives you is it gives you a way to specify bounds on resources and also verify them. For functional Scala programs that may have memoization and lazy evaluation. I'll try to explain what these features are shortly. So in our approach, users can specify the bounds that they like, and the system will try to only prove those bounds that they have specified. So the contribution of our tool is it presents novel techniques that can let you do this. It has a free and open source implementation that you can be accessed at this URL. And it has, we have evaluated it on quite a few benchmarks. And it comes with a lot of correctness proofs, but albeit it's with the pen and paper. Okay, so this is what you can do with the system is, here I'm showing a piece of code in Scala syntax. So you can write contracts with this in Scala using the keyword require. Require specifies a precondition and ensuring specifies a postcondition. And in require, you can state your invariants that may be necessary for proving the bound. If you're talking about red-black tree, your red-black tree invariants go here. And in the post conditions, you can talk about your resource properties. So in this case, I'm saying that the number of steps taken by this function is logarithmic in the size of the tree. And what we also allow is to have holes in the resource bounds that you specify, and these holes correspond to some numerical values. And these numerical values will be automatically inferred by the tool. This is a high-level view of what you can do with the system. And what's the problem? The problem is to find values for the holes that will make this bound a valid bound for all executions of the function, for all inputs. And we also want to make sure that this bound is as strong as possible with respect to this algorithmic resource. So here we are not talking about the physical units, as I mentioned before.
You also have to specify correctness properties?
You have to specify correctness properties. If this is, it depends. If you think of this as a correctness property, you think this is necessary to prove a logarithmic time bound. So you have to specify this property, which says that my input true satisfies the invariance of red-black tree. And only then I can establish a logarithmic time bound, right?
But what about the correctness of the algorithm? In other words, the algorithm could do nothing. And if it didn't,
if you want to also simultaneously prove correctness properties, which we actually do, then you can specify them along with your resource bounds in the post condition,
okay.
Which we often do. But we try to separate these two aspects. We prove correctness separately from resource bounds. Yeah.
So in this case, this is just shorthand. In general, the input will include the algorithm. Before you run the analysis.
Before I run the analysis?
You will be given the actual algorithm for insert or not.
Yeah, of course. Yep.
You're not trying to find an algorithm that will satisfy these bounds.
No. This is not a synthesis problem. I'm sorry. There should be some concrete piece of code here. All right. So
you're asking the user to also query the loop
invariants? Yes. To whatever extent that can be automatically inferred by the tool, it tries to infer it. But if your loop invariant actually involves red-black tree invariants, then you have to specify it. Yes. Because here there are no explicit loops, but there are only recursions. In the presence of recursion, your post conditions look very similar to loop invariants.
Can I write templates for those invariants?
You can. In fact, we automatically infer certain templates too for very simple positivity constraints. Yeah. All right. So now I'll talk about this aspect of memoization and lazy evaluation, which was also supported by the tool. By memoization, we refer to caching of the outputs of a function for each distinct input with which it's invoked at runtime. And the cache is maintained implicitly by the runtime. And it consists of the name of the function that is memoized, the argument with which it's invoked, and the result of the function. You can think of this table as maintained by the runtime. And what this lets you do is that if a program, if your language supports memoization and closures, then you can realize lazy evaluation using that. So you can think of lazy evaluation, which are basically computations that are suspended and then executed only at the point where you need it. These can be thought of as memoizing closures that take a unit argument. At some point you want to do a computation, you make it a closure, and then you memoize the closure. When you want to access the computation, the closure will get executed and the result will be cached. This is one way to think about lazy evaluation. But when you implement it, obviously you want to associate a mutable field and a data structure with thunk, and then you want to realize the memo table in that way. But this is a conceptual way to think about it. All right. So why are these features important? From a theoretical point of view, they make an eager functional language strictly more expressive or performant in an asymptotic sense. So you can write programs with these features that are asymptotically better than their counterparts in an eager language. This was proved by in the famous result by Bird and Moore. And there are many practical examples for that. So for instance, there is a huge class of lazy data structures, which was proposed by Chris Okazaki. And these lazy data structures, for instance, can create persistent data structures by exploiting these features, which run in the same complexity as data structures that can be implemented in a language with mutability. We also know of dynamic programming algorithms, which rely on memoization. And of course, all of you here are familiar with Link and Scala streams and all these kind of libraries. So these features practically are very important. And why are they attractive from the perspective of verification? Because of this reason, that they still retain the functional property of programs. So I can use them in specifications to talk about a functional nature to prove functional correctness of an implementation. So they preserve referential transparency. So heap can be assumed to be immutable. There's no frame problem here, which is a huge relief as far as if you want to write specifications are concerned. So you are very much in your familiar world as far as you are proving correctness properties. But what is the complication with resource usage? The complication with resource usage is the resource usage of a function depends on whether or not the lazy evaluation or the memoization has happened for a certain function. So these features are not transparent with respect to their resource usage. So this is the bad news in the sense the state of the cache is visible if you want to talk about resources. But the good news is you know what the state is. It's a cache and it's going to grow monotonically. So it seems we can exploit this, which I will explain in the course of this talk, and then try and develop an efficient system. Yep.
So part of the value of the memoization is that you get the same input over and over, and so you can speed up that particular call, right? But for particular, let's say the distribution of inputs is uniform random.
Okay.
Right, and in that case, and you're unlikely to ever see a value again, right? So under what circumstances, right, what do you have to say about the input distribution to reason about the performance?
That's a very good question. But you're talking about inputs that are top-level inputs to the function, right? Think about a Fibonacci function. In a Fibonacci function, you can call it with any input. But no matter what you call it with, it's going to call itself recursively on a lot of inputs over and over again. For instance, it's going to invoke the function recursively on n minus 1 and also on n minus 2. And invariably, n minus 2 is going to use everything that's computed by n minus 1, no matter what your input is.
So in a recursive function, the assumption about a uniform random distribution wouldn't be there.
So if you think of inner functions,
reused, right?
If you think of inner functions that are used to implement top-level functions,
right.
The inner functions are highly constrained
right.
by the environment with which it's called. Yep. So and there'll be a large use, as you can see, a lot of data structures depend on this. I would say even the most efficient functional implementation depend on lazy evaluation to achieve the kind of performance. All right.
Yeah, okay, we'll come back.
Okay, all right. So before I get into the actual technique, let me give you an overview of what the tool can do. So these were some of the benchmarks on which we tried. So we had benchmarks that does list operations, insertion sort and sorting on list, and certain kind of queue operations. And this is one template that I show here for one particular function. In this case, this is the bound that was inferred for an insertion sort algorithm. It's obviously quadratic in the size of the list. And these constants were inferred by the tool automatically. And we also considered a lot of search trees, including balanced trees like red, black tree, AVL tree, and so on and so forth. And this is one particular bound we established for balanced search tree. These constants were automatically inferred by the tool.
So you're only using constants. The templates, the holes can only be filled in by constants.
Yeah, as far as resource bounds go. For, as I said, there are certain correctness properties we can automatically infer using automatically generated templates. For instance, that the result of a function. In this case, all these functions required size to be a positive function. And it was, in most cases, not specified by the user. So the function automatically creates a template that says the result of the function is a linear combination of the result and the inputs of the function and tries to solve it in the context of inferring this resource bound. So it only infers as much invariant as you might actually want to prove this. For resource bounds, no, we don't do any automated analysis at all. If somebody wants to prove a bound, they have to specify it in the form of templates. Yes?
Depending on the heaps line,
yes.
Let's tune up to something funny.
Yeah, that's true. So on the heaps line, this is a bound for a binomial heap data structure. The binomial heap consists of a list of trees, a list of AVL-like trees, and this counts the number of trees and not the size of the heap structure, which will also include the number of nodes in the tree. So it just counts the number of trees. And this is enough if you want to prove a logarithmic time bound, which was not done in the tool because logarithmic time bound involves some kind of rational base for the logarithm, which wasn't within the scope of the system to do. But this was a pretty expressive one.
Why do you say 40 and then...
Yeah, that's
also... Sorry, come again? Why is it?
It seems like tree num of H1 and another tree num of H1. It's a typo or...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's true. This is H2. It's a typo.
Yeah.
So it's the yeah it's the time taken to merge two trees, H1 and H2, and this was the time bound. Thanks a lot. Sorry about that. All right, so we also considered program optimizations, and this was one interesting program where I tried to do a constant folding by using an interprocedural modular constant propagation. And this bound you see here is the time taken to compute summaries of the function, and it depends on the size of the program and the number of iterations you might need, which was provided as a counter, and it actually depends on the size of the lattice, the maximum number of iterations that you might need. And yeah, from this point, what you see is programs that try to exploit lazy evaluation. In this case, the goal was to compute the kth minimum of an unsorted list using a merge sort algorithm, but I don't want to search the sort the eagerly the input, but I want to do only as much work as required to access the kth minimum. And it turns out that you can do that in order of k times log of l dot size. So note that this is not order of n times log of l dot size. It's much better than that. And it also turns out to be the optimal complexity if you want to access all elements until the kth minimum. And so for such a complicated bound, our tool was able to infer these kind of constants and prove that the bound was correct. And these kind of data structures are called as lazy data structures, and they use a technique called scheduling. And we were able to also handle it. And this is one kind of data structure for which I don't know of any existing tool that can even talk about the invariance of these data structures. And then we also handle dynamic programming algorithms. And the bound you see here is for an algorithm that tries to do Viterbi.
So in terms of the what the user specifies, everything that's not bold in these things is specified by the user?
Yes.
Okay, so how do they know what formula, you know, what to put in there?
You're writing the implementation. It's a bit like...
So they have to have a pretty good understanding of the algorithmic
You have
structure.
To have a very good understanding of what you're trying to implement.
Okay.
It's a bit like doing software verification, but you're doing verification of resource bounds instead of correctness properties. You need to have a good idea about what you are implementing, what its running time bound is, and also the proof of how you can get there.
And I'm assuming you're the one that did all these?
Me and my colleagues.
So how much time did it take, say, for the
program? It depends on the benchmark. That's a very good question.
Yeah.
So for these, you don't have to write a lot of things at all.
Right.
So, but for these, almost 50% of the program was specifications. and this might appear at the first sight as something that is too much, but there is not even a pen and paper soundness proof of these data structures. Because even if you open an algorithm textbook, what you find there is a piece of natural language text. To even write invariants about these data structures is pretty complicated. And people are still trying to figure out theoretical frameworks of analyzing these data structures. And many of the precise running time bound of this class of data structures is still open. So.
The 896.
Oh, that means the number of chips taken by a function that tries to dequeue an element in this case was 896. It was a constant. Yep. It was a persistent enqueue and dequeue into a queue. Persistent in the sense that once you perform an enqueue or dequeue operation, you still have access to the earlier versions of the queue. You can still perform enqueue and dequeue on earlier versions of the queue, and this is a worst case time bound on that. So you can imagine the time of kind of complexity that's going in.
The bother about these templates is that if you look at row 2, right, size t plus 1, right,
yeah.
That plus 1 can be quite counterintuitive for someone
to provide. True. No, that's a very interesting point, and I agree that it's one of the drawbacks of the tool, because logarithm here happens to be a function that is defined by the user in the program. So, so in some sense, the system doesn't know a lot of properties of log. If you want to get rid of this constant, then you need to somehow say that log of size of t plus 1 is in fact upper bounded by log of size of t, and then we can put a constant outside it. So these properties are not automatically known to the system. So these are axioms of logarithm function, and it's a highly nonlinear function. So if you can provide these axioms, then you can get rid of this plus 1 here too.
So what would happen if I were to just enumerate lots of these terms, right? If I, for every benchmark, I put the union of all these terms.
Yeah, actually you can. It scales up to a certain point. There are many benchmarks here for which the coefficients were 0. So there were terms where we had an idea of what is the growth of the largest term there, whether it's order of mn or mn square or anything like that. And the smaller terms can be added. More smaller terms could be added. And this program can. One thing is it also introduces a complexity because the system will now try to find negative constants for these terms. It will not even try to eliminate it. Sometimes it will try to find negative constants. Yeah, so the more precise your template is, the more easier it would be for the system to solve it. But that's not a requirement, yes.
What happens if I don't specify enough of the terms?
All right, so that's a good question. If you have these kind of concrete constants in your template, then you can find a counterexample. But if you don't have these concrete constants and everything is left as question marks, then the system will simply time out saying, I cannot solve it. Right.
So if I left off that plus 1, I would get a counterexample that I would then basically debug manually and figure out that I hit the corner case that required plus 1. That would lead me back.
That's true, but I'm not very sure of this plus 1 because possibly you can increase the constant here. And then you would, if you had a wrong constant here, true. If you had a wrong constant here and you didn't put a plus 1 here, you'll get a counterexample eventually.
Right. So if I gave it x cubed instead of x squared,
right,
it would find a constant that works and say,
That's certainly possible. You can always over approximate your time bound, and it's going to solve it. And if you under approximate your time bound and all your constants are concrete, it will try to find a counterexample. But I should also warn you that when you go to very complicated data structures with very complicated invariants, counterexample solving will also not help you much. So,
So I'm a little lost term. What are you computing? Are you computing an under approximation to the worst case input or an over approximation?
Over approximation. But if you have a wrong time bound.
But then the over approximation can always be not too over approximate. So how does the user know that?
No, but it's constrained by the template. It cannot be too over approximate in this case. There is no other. You can possibly put a larger constant here. So there is a problem of computing minimality. But you cannot. You want minimal constants here, but you cannot add new terms here.
So it's an over approximation, but it is a minimal solution given your template.
Given your template, exactly.
I see.
Okay. Oh, is that really true? But you can guarantee that the number is the smallest correct number?
Yeah, under certain restrictions, not with nonlinearity.
But everything here is nonlinear, I don't understand everything here. What do you mean nonlinear?
If you have, so there are certain class of recursive functions. So here we are working with a very expressive form of template with recursive functions, data types and all this stuff. So by definition, even proving these bounds is undesirable. So there is no hope of getting any constraints on minimality here. But there is a class of recursive functions or data types called sufficiently surjective. This is just for theoretical interest, if you're interested. And the algorithm is complete with respect to sufficiently surjective functions. And that itself is not a trivial result because here you have a multiplication of an unknown with some other term in the program. So to answer your question, no in general, yes in very specific cases. All right. But we do evaluations, so I'll come to that. So at the current form, these are the kind of resources that are supported by the system. So the steps corresponds to the number of evaluation steps or number of primitive operations. It's well-defined, but it's mathematically defined. This is an intuitive way you can think about steps. And alloc corresponds to the number of objects allocated in the heap or cache. It doesn't distinguish between the size of the object. Stack corresponds to the number of call stack locations that you might need in measured in terms of 64-bit words. And depth corresponds, is a notion of parallel execution time, which corresponds to the chain of longest chain of data dependencies between your execution. I will not spend too much time on that. And rec corresponds to the number of recursive calls made by the function. It's, if you are only interested in proving asymptotic bounds, you can stick to this. And the constants involved are pretty simple in this case. All right, so there are lots of questions about why we verify this and whether the bounds are strong. So here is some, this will provide you some idea about it. So what we did is we tried to run the programs on concrete inputs and measure these abstract resources, such as steps and alloc. Here we are not measuring running time bounds, but for that happens at runtime. And then we compared it against the static estimate for that input. So we ran it over thousands of input over these benchmarks. And what you see here is the mean that is computed over all functions or all benchmarks. And what we find is when you are talking about the steps resource, the value that you achieve at runtime is at least 81% of the value that was statically predicted. The statically predicted value is the baseline. It's about 100%. And you achieve at least 81% of the value that you predicted statically.
But this is about a given specific input.
This is about average over all inputs, yeah.
Doing the resource consumed on a given concrete input.
Given concrete input.
And then a static estimate on a given concrete
input. Given concrete input.
But then that problem is much simpler because in some sense you can completely, you know, evaluate the program.
Only for that input, right? So if you are trying to establish a bound that insertion talk, for instance, red black tree runs in logarithmic size, you try to give a tree of size 1, then a tree of size 2, tree of size 3, and then measure.
So there are two scenarios, right? One is in which you first do an analysis and you have figured out the bound definition and then you instantiate that bound definition with the properties of the ith input.
That's what
as opposed to redoing the bound analysis
So here, what I mean by static estimate is you get the estimate that you have proven with all the constants by the tool, and then you're just working with this template that was inferred. Yeah, so for if you're talking about allocations, then the results are much better, and it goes up to 88%. And I'll present more results to show that there is a notion of inherent incompleteness here, which comes from the template. When we say that the time taken by an algorithm is logarithmic in its size, that's already an over-approximation. The actual time taken by the algorithm is, in fact, given by its implementation. And we want to have a log function as a user-defined way of analyzing the program. So there is inherently an over-approximation happening here, and that needs to be separated from the constants that are inferred by the tool. So I will talk about it in more detail with the results, but this gives you an idea of what our tool can achieve. OK, so I'm now getting into some concrete details on how you specify properties on these kind of functions. And I'll talk about the specification strategy, I'm sorry. One of the features of the tool is that you can write recursive functions in the contracts, and the recursive functions can talk about all entities in the program. For instance, I want to say that the tree is balanced. And what I would say in the specification is a property. In this case, it's called height balanced. And to say that the tree is height balanced, I want to say that the left subtree is height balanced, the right subtree is height balanced, and the difference between the height of the left and right subtree is bounded by some constant, in this case, k. Right? And this is a recursive function, so you can write and then put it in the precondition, and it will be used when, when we are trying to infer resource bounds. All right, so let's consider a slightly more complicated example of streams. And here I have a stream. In streams, the tail of the stream is produced on demand. And what you see here is a generator function that, when accessed, will try to produce the next node of the stream. And let's say I want to access the tail of the stream. What I get is another node whose tail is, again, a suspension. This we call a suspension, and so on. So the problem here is to access n elements. If invoking this function once takes order of n time, to access n elements, you'll probably spend order of n squared time. So the take function, when you invoke it for the first time, spends order of n squared time. But this is only for the first invocation. When you invoke the take function the second time, it only takes order of n time because all these values have been cached. So if I want to, I often want to specify that the elements of the tail has been cached already by a previous iteration. And then I want to prove that it takes only linear time. It can be done in the system. So what you do is we provide a construct And this construct is called cached. So this is an extension to the specification language. And it takes a function and a set of arguments. The semantics of that, it returns true only if the function is cached on the argument, and it returns false otherwise. So this is another variable in the program. So to say that at some point that my the first n elements of the stream has been concretized, I can write a function I call as concrete until. What it says the tail of the stream S is cached. And here, consider tail as some kind of a function that is applied over its receiver S. So it still fits into the same syntactic constraints. And then I can recursively call this function on the tail of the stream. So this can be a function that can be specified in the postcondition, and once you, sorry, in the precondition. Once you specify it, I can prove a constant time bound on the take function. This is one way to specify these kind of properties. Yeah, had a question?
When you think about memoization, you're only thinking about memoization with respect to recursion on the function from the top level down. In other words, after the function is returns at the top level, you eliminate the cache?
No, you don't eliminate the cache. So
how do you reason about the size of the cache over time?
I don't have to reason about the size of the cache over time, because as far as these abstract measures are concerned that we are evaluating, it only depends whether a certain call is in the cache or not. It doesn't matter how big your cache is. I agree that at runtime, the size of the cache has some performance penalty on how quickly you can look it up.
Right.
But those kind of constants, it's pretty much the same as the time it would take to look up a hardware cache. Right? Here, the cache is somewhat implemented in the software level. So that's abstracted as some kind of a constant time overhead to look up a cache.
So you're saying, but there's two things. I guess one is the question of, do you have a bound on the size of the cache over multiple invocations of a particular function? That's one question.
No, we don't.
Okay, so it could become arbitrary. And then you don't reason about the cost of an access because,
So the only thing that matters is whether the cost of looking up into the cache depends on whether the function is in the cache or not. It's independent of the size of the cache.
Right.
So that's the assumption that's made here. So you cannot reason about size of the cache. And this makes sense when you're thinking about, typically these kind of memoization is not done the way that I have mentioned in this slide, because that was more for a conceptual reason. Typically they're implemented using lazy evaluation and those kind of implementation level hacks, right? So the cache is kind of distributed and stored with every reference or every closure in your program. So the time to access the cache is almost a constant. It's not a very heavyweight access in terms of lazy evaluation. You have a concrete reference, and you're just looking up the field of the reference. And if the field is set, then you have the cached value. If not, you don't have the cached value. All right. So here is another example. In this case, we have a dynamic programming algorithm, which is the knapsack problem. And we are given a sack of capacity C and a set of items, each of value VI and weight WI. And we need to find an optimal way to fill up this sack. The way we do that is using dynamic programming. We basically compute the max of filling the sack with the item and without the item. And we add the value of the item if it is chosen in this sack. So this simple recursion actually captures this. So if you look at a dynamic programming, a bottom-up evaluation of this, first what I would do is I would try to compute the optimal value for filling up a sack of capacity 1, then a sack of capacity 2, and all the way up to n, if n is the capacity that I am given. And using this recurrence relation. And what happens is at any given point, if I want to compute the optimal capacity for value m, then it only depends on the number of items, because all the recursive calls have been previously invoked and memoized. So this is the invariant that I want, and this is the resource bound I want to establish, saying that for each call runs an order of items dot size time. So overall, it takes n times order of items dot size time. So how you can say that? You can say that, again, using this predicate and a recursive function. And this property says that whenever you are invoking the ks function on n, it is cached for n minus 1. You assert this as a precondition of the ks function, and you can establish these kind of bounds. All right. Any questions on this? OK. So here is another aspect I want to talk about the specification. And this deals with a class of data structures I call as lazy data structures. And a property about these data structures is they have a stream. So at a certain point, you don't have the tail materialized, but it's basically a suspension. In this case, ink denotes a suspension. And the second argument of that suspension is another stream. So these are data structures that have a suspension that points to another suspension. And what you have is another data structure that points or keeps the references of all these suspensions which have not been materialized yet. So what you do is whenever you want to, you perform an operation on this, you try to access an element from the schedule. And by accessing an element from the schedule, you're trying to materialize the data structure one step. And this aspect is utilized to create very highly efficient data structures that are persistent and also have a worst case constant time bound if you're performing queue inserts or deletes. And this is one data structure that was used to implement data parallel operations in Scala. And what is interesting here is you want to specify equalities between closures, because this is a closure, and this is keeping a list of references to closures. You want to say, this points to a closure inside this stream. This is something we can do in our system. You can equate closures. That's something that's not possible in a lot of systems. And I'll probably not talk a lot about it, but that gives you some idea about what you can do. So just to summarize what are the novel aspects about specification is you can write, you can express resource bounds in the postconditions of functions as templates with numerical holes. And the contracts can involve recursive functions and also nonlinearity. And we provide a construct called cached, which can use to query the cache about whether a function has been cached or not. And you can also use equality between closures to say whether two closures represent the same reference. Okay, so now I'll talk about, give an overview of how our technique tries to handle these kind of features. So just to come back to the problem is given such a template, we need to find values for the constant that will make it hold for all executions of the function, right? And we also want to infer constants that are as strong as possible. So at a high level, what is the challenge here? The challenge here is we have programs with all these high-level features. We have recursive functions, recursive data types, higher-order functions, memoization, aliasing of closures. And what we have at the level of solvers is some kind of small set of decidable theories. We have linear arithmetic, we have inductive data types, we have uninterpreted functions and sets. And like a compiler that compiles from high-level features to assembly code, a verifier is in some sense compiling these features down to these set of decidable theories using logical frameworks and then inferring values and communicating those values back to these, translating them back to these high-level features. So this is the grand challenge here, to handle all these features, map them onto small set of decidable theories, and then you work with those decidable theories. So the way the approach works is it obviously takes multiple phases to do this. In the first phase, what happens is we convert resource bounds in the function into encode them as invariants of the program. And we generate a first-order program that does not have any closures or doesn't have any effects of memoization. But the program completely captures the resource usage of the input function, and it only uses theories that are efficiently decidable. So it only uses algebraic data types, sets, and arithmetics. But it's still a program, and it can have recursive functions. So what happens in the second phase is we take this first-order program, and we generate a there exists for all formula. The formula is existentially quantified because we have holes in the postconditions. And this formula is then fed to a counterexample-driven algorithm, which tries to infer values for the constants that will make the formula unsatisfiable. And these results are communicated back through the first-order program back to your source program. Okay, so I'll briefly go over each of these steps. And the first step is about translating a program with resource bounds to something that doesn't have resource bound and converting the problem of resource bound inference to invariant inference. So the simplest way to think about that is what happens is we are having a source program, and what we generate is a program in which if the program computes the result of the evaluation, it also computes the resource usage of the expressions of the program. So the program not only computes the results, but it also tracks resource usage in addition to the result. And now what happens is these resources that were implicit in the source program become explicit references to entities of the program. And any bound on these explicit entities or any invariant on these explicit entities are also invariants on the resources at the source level. But here we also have to take care of effects of memoization. So you are given an input state. You can think of it as some abstraction of the state of the cache. And we also return an output state. In this case, caches are represented using the set of values in the cache in an appropriate way that can be useful for verification. So now we have a program that is first order. It doesn't have memoization effects. Everything is encoded into this functional subset. And now, so I'll talk about how we can verify specifications of this first order program. But recall that this first order program still has specifications. They are just now talking about variables in the program and not resources. The most, I would say, conventional way of proving programs with contracts is to use some kind of an inductive reasoning, which I call as modular function level reasoning. You are given a precondition, a body, and the postcondition. What you want to establish is that when the precondition holds and the body holds, these are formulas that represent the expressions in the program. And you can hypothesize that the postcondition holds for all the recursive calls. You want to imply that the postcondition holds under this assumption. So you assume that the postcondition holds for recursive calls, and you establish the postcondition for the top level call. This is performing an induction over the number of recursive calls made by the function. And you also want to establish that at every point where the function is called, its precondition holds, but only under a path in which it is called. But, well, this is something that we can use, but it has problems with when you go for higher order functions and when you have state-dependent contracts. What this example illustrates the challenge. The complexity here is there is a function main that creates a lambda term, and the lambda term invokes a function called g. And this function g has a precondition p of x. But this function applies, this lambda term applies the function over a captured argument x. X here is captured. It's not an argument to the lambda term. But it's invoked in some other context where you only pass the argument to the lambda. There is no access to the captured argument. But the precondition on the function is talking about a property on the captured argument. So at the point of invoking the lambda term, you don't have access to the captured arguments. But you want to establish a precondition that should hold at the point of invocation of the or application of the lambda term. So this is a problem in the sense that the original modular reasoning that cannot take care of it. But here, you can make an observation that the property we want to establish in some form must hold at the point of creation. But the problem here is we have contracts that depend on the state of memoization that can query the cache. So a property that holds here may not necessarily hold here because it changes with the evolution of the cache. The cache has changed from this point to the point where it's being invoked. So what we do is we consider a class of properties called as cache monotonic properties. So what we know is that the cache is going to evolve monotonically. You can only add more elements to it. And you often find that the resource usage of a call is anti-monotonic with respect to the cache. Given a larger cache, you can only expect a smaller, the same or smaller amount of resource usage for normal resources like time and space. And so you can, in most cases, you're going to talk about invariants that are going to imply resource bounds. So those invariants can be made, or in most cases, they are already cache monotonic, which means if they hold in a smaller cache, they also hold in a larger cache. Concrete until was an example that I showed you. If you can show that the list is concretized up to n elements in a smaller cache, it will be concretized up to n elements even in a larger cache. What it gives you is you can do this. You can basically prove a property at the point of creation of a lambda, and you can assume the property at the point of invocation of the lambda. So that's something that happens in our tool. And this I call as creation dispatch reasoning, but it comes with its own set of challenges, which I will not go into. One thing is the point of creation of the function should only involve functions that are well-defined or terminating. So any crashes at the point of creation of a lambda will also translate to at the point of invocation of the lambda. So here you're linking two pieces of code which are far apart and which even may not have any interaction in the piece of code that's given to you, because the creator and the invocation points could be completely separate given the piece of code that you are analyzing. They may be related by a client, but you don't see how they are related. So there are some challenges here. So let me come back to this question of to the grand picture. And what we have is we have from a program to a formula, but now the formula will also have holes. So the goal is to try and find values for the holes that will make this formula valid. So which means is I have to universally quantify over the set of inputs. So I have a formula that's universally quantified over the set of inputs. I want to find values for the constants that will make it valid. Yep.
So
encoding the minimality of ANB?
No, not yet. It's not yet encoded. Good question. What we do is, you can see this formula as basically trying to find unsatisfiability of phi, where phi is negation of psi. So you want to find some values for the constants that will make phi unsatisfiable, and those piece of constants will make psi valid. All right. So this is how we picture the problem at the level of solving it. So we are given, and our algorithm is counterexample driven, and it has these kind of, at a high level, these kind of components. We are given a formula A implies B, and it has recursive functions. It has nonlinearity and all this algebraic data types and all the other operations. It first goes through a phase called unfolding of functions, where you try to inline functions up to a certain depth and treat the functions that are not inlined as uninterpreted, because we have to try to come up with an over approximation. So we have to treat them as uninterpreted, which gives you some information that when the function is invoked with same arguments, it returns the same result. So what you end up is a formula that has uninterpreted functions but no recursive functions. What we also do is we try to instantiate axioms for nonlinearity and try to get rid of nonlinearity and treat them as uninterpreted functions with axioms. And the goal here is to find an assignment for these variables A bar that will make this entire formula unsatisfiable. So this formula has both A bar and X bar. I want to find values for A bar that will make it unsatisfiable. And this counterexample driven algorithm has two components. It has something called an exist solver and a for all solver. What exist solver does, it tries to come up with an initial guess for these kind of holes. Let me call them holes. And if the formula is unsatisfiable under the initial guess, so we are done. We are good, so we have found a solution. But in most cases, it won't be. And so the for all solver tries to find a counterexample path in the formula. You can think of it as a disjunct that will basically make the formula satisfiable for your choice of constants. You want to make the formula unsatisfiable, but you found a counterexample that is now satisfiable. What the exist solver does is then it tries to get rid of certain theory operations in there, such as inductive data types and uninterpreted functions, and creates a purely numerical formula. And this numerical formula, it's a conjunction of inequalities, numerical inequalities, and it can be made unsatisfiable through an idea called Farkas lemma. And it generates, in some sense, a new set of values that will make this conflicting disjunct unsatisfiable. But only this disjunct. There could be more disjuncts in the formula that could be satisfiable. So what we do is we communicate this constant to the for all solver, which tries to find a new counterexample that will violate our current guess. And this process goes on until you have proven all disjuncts in the formula to be unsatisfiable. But this is a terminating algorithm, because the number of disjuncts in a formula is finite. So eventually, could be really large, but it is still finite. So this is a terminating algorithm. And to design a formula to be satisfiable or unsatisfiable, we run Z3 and CVC4 in portfolio mode. And once we have found a solution, we'll try to find for a smaller solution, which is something that I'll talk about now. OK, so this is the algorithm I illustrated. I will skip it in the interest of time. So let's imagine that we found one solution to our formula. So what we do is we do some kind of binary search at this point. And let's say the initial assignment in this case was A was 100 and B was 30. And I try to come up with some kind of an ordering on the coefficient so that the faster growing terms are ranked higher than the slower growing terms. So here A will be ranked higher than B. And we'll try to first minimize A followed by minimizing B. So here I'm going to search for a value of A that is less than half of my initial value. Either I find one or I don't find one. If I find one, I can further minimize it by halving it. If not, I can narrow down my search and get into a range. And this process goes on, and you'll finally find some minimal value for A. Let's say it's 51. And in this case, B can be completely random because B was unconstrained. B was initially 30, but now because you have minimized A, B could be 500, let's say. And so we'll fix the value of A to be 51 and then go on minimizing B. So at a high level, this is how the finding of minimal constants works. But these constraints are directly added to inside the system so that we don't have to do it at the top level. But in principle, this is what happens. OK. So let me get back to some more experimental results. So far, at this point, the tool has been evaluated on about 50 programs. Most of these programs are implementing very complex Scala algorithms. And it comprises of about 8,000 lines of Scala code and about 250 functions were proven for the time bound. But these are not simple programs. These are programs that implement one of the most sophisticated functional algorithms. So the analysis time at most was 5 minutes, but that was for really complicated programs with a lot of specifications. On an average, it's about 10 seconds. And one of the, I would say, the real trademark or the special point of the algorithm is this kind of data structures called Okazaki scheduling-based data structures, which, to my knowledge, doesn't even have a formal proof of correctness for running time. All right, so here are some more results. Here it also talk about other resources like alloc, which counts the number of objects that are allocated in the heap. This one is the time bound for knapsack algorithm, so there is some nonlinearity here. And this was a Packard parsing algorithm, tries to parse parse a string of size n using Packard parsing. And here you find a stack bound for merge sort. The stack bound for merge sort is linear in the size of L, even though the time bound is n log n. And here you see a steps bound for a function that converts a formula into negation normal form when the formula is represented as an abstract syntax tree. All right. So here are some comparisons with some related techniques that can solve problems such as these. So there is a technique called SIGIS, most of you here are experts in fact, and it's called as counterexample guided inductive synthesis. And it tries to solve an alternating quantifier problem, much like the algorithm I showed before. But one of the problems with SIGIS is SIGIS is not meant for these kind of bounds that I showed you. And it can very easily diverge in this case, because at any given point, you can think of SIGIS as or making one input not possible. We are trying to find a formula to be unsatisfiable. And it is trying to find a solution that will make one input unsatisfiable, but that could be an infinite set of inputs or at least a large number of inputs, so it can diverge. In our case, we are trying to make an entire disjunct in each case unsatisfiable. And our results, in fact, showed that. So SIGIS, without any bounds, did not scale at all. And with bounds, it was extraordinarily slow. We implemented SIGIS, because there was no tool that can handle the kind of constraints that we had. So, all right, so here are some details on how we measure the accuracy of the bounds that were inferred. So as I mentioned before, we tried to run the program on concrete inputs and compared it with the static estimate that we have for that concrete input. And these were the results. We found that about 80% of the worst case concrete resource usage was about 80% of what was inferred by the tool. All right, so here is a pictorial representation of this program that tries to compute the kth minimum using a bottom-up merge sort algorithm. So in this case, the bound was fairly complicated. And if you want to visualize this, this is how the statically inferred bound compares with the runtime execution. So you have size that varies along this axis. It goes from 0 to 20,000, the size of the list. And the minimum that you want to find varies from 0 to 100. So in this case, you want to find the 100th minimum of the list. And this shows the number of steps in millions. And what you find here is how the dots here show the actual runtime resource usage. And the lines here show this particular formula, how it varies with the inputs.
Are there cases where it diverged quite a bit from
there were cases where
it diverged quite a bit. What happened in those cases?
So in those cases, there were two reasons why it diverged. So one was we didn't have sufficiently strong invariants that will enable us to prove strong resource bounds, because the invariants, if you provide more invariants, the tool chokes because they were so complicated. And the second reason is what I'm going to discuss now. So this was the behavior, a similar graph for longest common subsequence problem. So also it also consists of two variables, m and n. And m and n varies along the x-axis. And this is a similar comparison for knapsack. And you can see there is some amount of divergence here as well. And this is not small, given that the steps is in millions. So I'll just point that out myself, in the sense you are wondering about it. So that is a divergence. But let's see, what are the reasons for divergence? The reasons for divergence could be the template which specifies a closed form solution, because we are trying to characterize a complex implementation using a closed form solution for its resource bound. And that is one big source of approximation. The second thing is the constraints inferred by the tool itself. This is something that the tool we can handle if we design a better algorithm. And to compare this, what we did is we tried to minimize one constant in the bound, fixing other constants as such, so that it conflicts with one of the actual runtime data that we have. And then what you use is you try to measure the static estimate with respect to this bound that was minimized with respect to dynamic data. It was only an unsound approximation because this bound may be violated by an input that you haven't tried. You have no idea. But at least it's valid for all the bounds that you have tried. And you try to do this, you get a large number of bounds for each function, take an average of it, and this is what you get. What you get is, if you compare instead of against dynamic run, against this Pareto optimal bound, the Pareto optimal bound is about 91% of what was predicted by the tool. So you can say the remaining, in this case 9%, was loss of constants that were inferred by the tool. And if the percentage goes really high if you're looking at other resources like alloc, where the constants are small and the programs are also simple. Okay, so here are some more evaluations. And again, I'm not claiming steps relate to running time bound. That would be a really wild claim if I make. But what I can show is you can see that these algorithms are not simple. They have lazy evaluation, you have closures, and they are running on Java virtual machine. Despite that, what I find is, in this case, I plot the number of seconds it took to perform one step. And it almost took 1 nanosecond, and the variation was 0.01 nanosecond. That was absolute deviation. And in this case, the amount of time that each step takes is different across benchmarks. But for each benchmark, it is fairly consistent with very small absolute deviation. And what our tool managed to do is it finds bounds that are pretty close in all three cases, about 90%. Okay, so I'll try to conclude this with this slide. So it is indeed the class of programs we are considering are very hard. But it's not that we have to completely give up on them. There is still some hope, and what this work shows is we can try and prove bounds for these programs, at least at the level of certain abstract complexities, if not in terms of concrete physical units. And some of the benchmarks that we consider in the study cannot be handled by any other tool that I am aware of. And this has been extended to prove amortized bounds, because we are in a very expressive system where users can provide specifications, and it has a free and open source implementation. And this is an online interface to it. You can try some benchmarks from that. Okay, so before I conclude, I'll just try to give a brief overview of other projects I have worked on over the years. And this was one project I collaborated with Sumit. And in this project, we tried to come up with a tutoring system for context-free grammars that will enable students to learn context-free grammars. And one of the contributions of the system was it implemented algorithms to prove and disprove to context-free grammars. And it was able to detect incompatibilities between grammars of real-world languages like Java, C#, and so on. And I should say that this is used very regularly in EPFL compilers course since 2014. Students also like it a lot. And here's another problem I worked on when I was at Microsoft Research, and also for some years after that, was a static modular heap analysis for C#. And this analysis is special in the sense that it comes up with new algorithms to perform heap analysis modularly in the presence of two difficult features, higher order functions that we find often in C#, and objects, obviously. And it does this, it can analyze libraries independent of clients, and then when the clients are given, it can incrementally compose the results to obtain the solutions for the program. And it supports a lot of applications. So one application was call graph construction. It's used by verifiers like Coral, which was developed by Akash Lal and Shaz Kadir. And by itself, it supports side effects analysis, escape analysis, and taint analysis, which was also developed for the purpose of reasoning about certain programs and for a privacy analysis needed inside Microsoft. And more recently, it was used to perform deadlock detection, static deadlock detection for C# programs. And this work appeared in PLDA 2017. I'm not a co-author of that work. All right, so I'll stop with this slide, and thanks for your attention.
Sorry, how are you thinking of taking the work on reasoning about bounds forward?
So there are many directions here. So it depends on what interests me more. But one thing is we can try and handle programs with mutability, so that we can go to try and analyze much more real-world programs instead of sophisticated algorithms. So another aspect is, even in terms of handling programs modularly in the presence of higher-order functions, there are certain challenges, because it requires if you want to reason about a program independent of a higher order program independent of a client, it's very challenging because this higher order program can make calls, callbacks that are defined in the clients. So for this purpose, there are notions like higher order contracts, and that is one direction to explore whether such higher order contracts can be used with resource bounds, but it's again difficult for a number of reasons. So it becomes difficult because you then have to specify the concrete time bound that was taken by functions that are passed in, which is again difficult. And let's see. So the another direction in which this can be taken forward, it's more tangible also, is to infer automatically constants in the program. We often use constants to fine-tune a program. Infer them, that will make a program satisfy a certain time bound. So what you do is you typically have, in this happens in parallel worlds where I have a merge sort implementation and I switch to a sequential implementation when a certain threshold is reached. And it's hard to compute the threshold and it's dependent on the hardware and runtime. So I want to do it again and again over different hardwares and runtime. This process pretty much falls in the framework that I described here. You know a structure about the thresholds, but you don't know the exact constants in there. So you can use the tool to try and infer those constants and make sure a program is as optimal as possible. That's one direction. And a more, maybe I'll say, long-term ambitious direction is you want to, given specifications on running time bounds in addition to correctness specifications, you may want to aim at automatically coming up with an implementation that will that'll satisfy this. It's not too far away because, again, if you look at these abstract bounds, they are getting translated to some form of invariant inference after instrumentation. So something that's still tangible.
Bounds.
That's a very interesting question. So one thing you can do within the framework of the system is to create clients which will run the invoke this function for which you want to measure the average case on inputs that will only arise in the average case. So for instance, with amortized algorithms, this is what we do. We create a client, and the client is going to call the APIs of the data structure for multiple operations. And you can leave these operations in some sense unconstrained. They can be, what the operation should be should come as an input. The system already takes as parameters unknown inputs. So you can always say, I don't know what are the operations are, but I'm going to run it on a sequence of operations. And now you try and establish a bound on it. And on top of this, if you add an invariant that characterizes your average case input, saying that my average case input in case of quicksort, my pivot is going to be somewhere, or my input is going to be fairly uniformly random, then you can try and establish average case bounds. Instead of saying my input is skewed one way or the other, it's going to be either descendingly sorted or ascendingly sorted. If you rule out those kind of inputs, then you can try and establish average case bounds. So if not, then it's still possible, but it requires much more, I would say, profound extensions.
The solving strategy that you mentioned about this binary search,
yeah,
that seems a bit wasteful because you are solving the entire problem in all from scratch. Could you have done and gone inside the solver and did something so that it was selecting?
Yeah, that's what we do actually. As I actually mentioned it as a passing comment. So we don't do it at the level of VCs. That's completely wasteful, like you said. What we do is at the level of Farkash lemma constraints. So what we have is we have some constraints that will generate a solution that will make all paths that were explored up to a certain point false. So once you have those constraints, you can automatically try and do this binary search on the results of this constraints. But the new solution you obtain may not be something that will make all paths you have seen unsatisfiable, all paths you have not seen unsatisfiable, because the constraints only encode paths that were seen thus far, right? And from somehow by luckily, when you solved it, the first time you got a solution that will make the entire formula unsatisfiable. But now you are trying to find a minimal solution which may no longer satisfy the entire formula. May not make the entire formula unsatisfiable. So you have to repeat this algorithm using the new solution, find a conflicting distant and proceed. Yeah, so that's what we actually do. But we don't go all the way to the solver level because solvers are not something that we developed. So getting there are engineering difficulties in doing this at the level of solvers, but we do it slightly at a higher level. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Okay, so let's have a look. Thanks a lot.